why were we redeemed by an orphan? Mordechai adopted Esther. Ain la avein, she didn't have parents. So the question could be asked two ways, historically and literally. Historically, okay, she lost her parents. Many people lost their parents in the Galus 70 years earlier. And this is a Megillah's way of saying that Megillah's Esther can't be appreciated without seeing it in the context of the Galus. A lot of people were orphans. A lot of people didn't have parents, and Esther was one of them. But why is it so important for Esther to be an orphan? So part of the answer is because Am Yisrael, as we've talked about so often, felt orphaned. They felt as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu, their father, Bashamayim, had forsaken them. So when the Megillah starts, Esther's being an orphan represents or symbolizes what Am Yisrael felt. And by the end, she redeems them. And it may have been easier for them to identify with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the Melech than to identify with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as their father, because a child who betrays the father, that's a relationship of love. And they felt the relationship of love had been compromised through all those years of sin and all the years of the first Beis HaMikdash. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the Melech, well, that's a different way. That's already demanding and decrees and responsibility and authority. So they're trying to slowly rebuild their relationship with Hashem as a father. But the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a Melech, it's much easier for them to identify with. So this is a statement. Ein la avaim means Am Yisrael felt that they didn't have a father. And they did still feel that they had a Melech. And the Melech and the Malka direct the proceedings. It's hard to know when they recovered the Av identity, because in the Megillah you don't really see a father coming into the picture and behaving like a father. That's something I'm still trying to think about. When were they able to see Hashem as their father? Obviously, once the miracle happened, Kimu v'kibul Yehudim, it was great success and great celebration, but we never see a father figure coming into Megillah Esther saying, oh, now, in the beginning of the Megillah, before the Nays, when they're still in Galus, they don't feel that they have a father, now they do feel they have a father. Another reason that the Megillah wants us to know that Esther was an orphan is because she was adopted by Mordechai. Why is that important? Listen to the language of the Medrash. The Medrash says, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ata darash tashlom nefesh achas, Chayecha selfchon l'drosh shlom u'ma shleima. Then Mordechai adopts Esther. Before any of Mordechai's heroism on the grand stage of history, and reversing the genocidal decree, and becoming a viceroy to the king, and writing a new sefer in Tanakh, he just performs one small, quiet, unknown act of chesed by adopting a child who doesn't have any parents, and no one knows she's destined for greatness and destined for glory. And I've talked about this so often with you, how small, minor acts of courage, those are the acts that change history. And in Mordechai not adopted Esther, she may have been killed, she may have been a street vagabond, who knows what would have happened to Esther, maybe adopted by a Persian family. So the fact that Mordechai, at some point, before Megillas Esther begins, when we're not paying attention, before it's being chronicled, reaches out and takes in this strange woman who doesn't have a parent, and no one wants anything to do with her, that ultimately shifts history. That ultimately leads her to being minted as the queen, and to Mordechai's rise, and to the Jewish salvation. So the Torah wants us to realize that large acts in history come from small acts, and big changes of history come from small, minor, courageous acts that no one watches. And that's why the Torah says, "Vehiomena sadasa, selfcha, you're going to change the world." But you change the world because you change one person's world where no one was paying attention. Okay, when Mordechai is introduced, Ish Yehudi, Haya, Bishishana Bira. So the two words here that stick out are Ish Yehudi. So the Medrash, these are all Midrashim. Ish Yehudi. Here's a man who is alone. Which sounds, why was he alone? Because most of the Jews bowed down to Haman. Which, of course, parallels Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. Most of the Jews bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol, except for Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. So you have Ish Yehudi, a person who wasn't afraid to make a defiant stand and be different from everyone. So Chazal compare him to Avraham. Avraham is Avraham Ivri. Okay, so that you've heard before. If not, it's pretty straightforward. It's pretty transparent. But why the word Haya? What is the word Haya B'Shoshana Bira? Ish Yehudi B'Shoshana Bira. We know he was there. He's living there. So Chazal say, Hu Tchilaso V'Sofo. That the word Haya is always used in Tanakh when a person doesn't change their feathers. When they act consistently, if we call with integrity, from the beginning of the story to the end of the story. Mordechai doesn't budge. He sees Haman in the beginning, doesn't bow down. He sees Haman later, doesn't bow down. As I told you on Friday, when he's finally promoted, he goes back to his Sakwa Betanisa, goes back to David. You get the sense that Mordechai is a person of great principles, as we would say, a person of integrity. Why is this important? Because Achashverosh was not. Achashverosh was very fickle. Achashverosh, Medrash says, killed his wife through his advisor's advice, and killed his advisor through his wife's advice. Namely, he kills Vashti because of Memuchan, and he kills Haman because of Vashti. And of course, genocide is something you can buy. So you see someone who's easily persuaded, very fickle, changes his feathers, is always changing his opinion, as we call wishy-washy, he's very unprincipled. So why is this important? Again, you have to read Megillas Esther on many levels. There's a historical level, there's a theological level, there's a moral level. Megillas Esther is teaching us one of the traits of morality is be consistent. Not to be someone who easily changes their opinion just because of monetary profit, because of sexual pleasure, or because someone gives you advice. Right? That advice issue is a very, very important part of Megillas Esther. I don't have time to amplify it. Is it good to listen to advice? When should you not listen to advice? Achshavosh is always being advised, but you get the sense that there's no backbone. He's very easily swayed by advice. At no point does Ahasuerus say, this is what I believe, this is what I think we should do. He's very easily manipulated. So part of it is having a position, maintaining that position, even when things don't seem to be going your way, as it was for Mordechai. Again, the higher level, the historical level, is that Am Yisrael was very fickle in this first Beis HaMikdash. And one of the great, great tochachos of the Nevi'im are, you're constantly being swayed politically between Bavel, Ashur, and Mitzrayim, religiously between the different Nevi'im, Habal, and sexually. So there's a message to Am Yisrael, be like Mordechai, be Haya, Tchilas HaVasofo, be maintain your loyalty. And the second Beis HaMikdash they did. You can say a lot about the second Beis HaMikdash, but they never veered from their Emunah in Hashem. They never veered from their position. They were broken up internally by internal fraction, but they never lost that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So this word Haya, B'Shoshana Bira, is seen by Chazal as a pivotal word. Every word gets extrapolated in the Medrash. If you get a chance to read the Medrash after you finish reading Ezra and Daniel, you'll see all these words contained. They're like icebergs. Like that little picture outside, the tip of an iceberg, and underneath, there's so much to study. Finally, what was wrong with the Suda of Achashverosh? Talmidim of Shimon ben Lakish, or Shimon bar Yochai, asked the Rebbe, why were the Jews punished? Or Megillah, Shimon bar Yochai says, because he says, you answer. They said, because of the Suda. What was so wrong about the Suda? So there's a historical level. I've talked about this before. Jews are dying in Yerushalayim. You're living in Shushan. It's one thing to live in Shushan. It's another thing to be celebrating 180 days of intoxication and orgy. Just have sensitivity to what's happening back in Eretz Yisrael. Number two is moral. This was a licentious, debauched, degenerate party. People are throwing up a chasar ginas b'sad hamelech. This is exhibitionism. This is opulence. This is not a place for a Jew. Part of your life over the next 5-10 years until you settle down is going to be a series of decisions that have to be made, not just based on the yardstick of whether it's kosher, the food is kosher, whether the environment is kosher. There's certain environments that the food is kosher you shouldn't be in. I can't tell you give you some general ones, but if you go to secular college, well, I'll get a bracelet Erev Shabbos, and I'll go to the game, and I'll keep Shabbos. Shabbos Lashem, you're sitting in a stadium with 30,000 people screaming their heads off. That's not Shabbos Lashem. Or you're going to, I don't know, I remember, I these things change. The goalpost always moves. I have to be very careful before I speak about them. But like 20 years ago, I was a rabbi in Camp Hask, and some of the boys who didn't ask my opinion, but I found out later, they went to a casino. It depends what type of casino it is. But you don't walk into Las Vegas. Las Vegas is a place that people come to lose their lives, their money, their lives, their marriages. It's all manipulative. They pump in oxygen. There's no clocks, a lot of lights. You're not in this environment where people come to commit suicide one way or another. I don't care if the shul's taking a trip. I don't care if the shul had a casino night. Okay, whatever. It struck me the wrong way. Maybe they could have called it differently. It was in the shul basement, whatever. But just once you have a casino night in Young Israel of Chicago, whatever, then you're two steps away from, well, now we'll go to the casino. You don't go there. It's not a place for yidden. It's not a place where you have to protect your neshama, not just protect your esophagus. You have to protect, what's coming into your neshama. So how could you find yourself at that suda? Like, it's unfathomable for you to be at that suda. But the Medrash has a third reason. You have to read Megillah on many planes. Is that this was the first time that humanity had accumulated such wealth. You're seeing the wealth and the opulence. And I talked about it the other day, how you had the wealth of the Jewish people being transferred to Ashur, being transferred to Babel, not being transferred to Paras and Madai. So you had intergenerational wealth. You have generational wealth doubling over on itself. You got the Trumps and the Rockefellers and wealth upon wealth upon wealth upon wealth. And Achashverosh said, I will provide a suda for you that even HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't provide. They said, no, you can't. They came to the suda and said, you know what? When we get to Olam Haba, we'll tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we already had Olam Haba and Olam Hazeh. And you just get the sense that humanity in general and the Jewish people, they just don't know how to deal with wealth. They haven't seen anything like this. people lived very Spartan lives. They lived in caves, they lived in huts, they ate whatever little, you know, rats or rabbits they could catch. We didn't eat rats and rabbits, but, you know, the mountain people did. We ate whatever little we had. We didn't have such wealth. Even in the days of Shlomo, you don't see this accumulation of wealth. And they just didn't know how to handle it. We're living through that saga again. We haven't had such wealth in our people since the Spanish era. And I just feel like a lot of people, they're not suffering theologically. They're not suffering even morally on the day-to-day, their behavior. But just the wealth is very dizzying. And we need to start thinking about, I don't have the answers to that because we don't have Sfarim. We can't look back and say, what did the Noda B'Yudha say to people about their wealth? He didn't say anything because they were poor as field mice. What did the Maharal say to the people in Prague? Are you kidding me? Wealth is the last one on everyone's mind. Here you get people who are destabilized. Like how to, and a lot of you will be wealthy or you'll be people with wealth. And you have to know, how do you counsel them to deal with it? It's not an amoral question, like amoral. It's not an immoral question, but it's not an amoral question. Like, what you do with your money, as long as you pay tzedakah and you write checks and, you know, you don't steal and embezzle, you're fine. Like, well, how do you work in sneers? And how do you work in spirituality? And how do you work in prioritization? Thank God I'm not wealthy, so I don't have to deal with these issues. But it's a whole scene in the beginning of Achashverosh that Chazal want us to see through these lenses. It wasn't just the food mezuzah, it wasn't just the Jews were dying in Yerushalayim, it wasn't just the debauchery, but just, oh yeah, we don't need Olam Haba anymore, we have Olam Hazeh. At a certain point, if you have too much Olam Hazeh, you forget about Olam Haba. And that's really what I think is happening to our people. We're becoming so immersed in Olam Hazeh that our thoughts of Olam Haba become very distant from our identity, from our existence, even if all the food is kosher in Shisha. Okay, tomorrow's our last day of the Megillah. Let's see if we can make fun of a couple other committees. We've got Tina Kalei in Chicago.